This episode of The Y-Files is brought to you by PDS Debt.
Gather round, because this happened. Suffolk, England, October 1957. Three Royal Navy cadets walked across Green Hills on a training exercise, map reading and orientation. William Lang, Michael Crowley, and Ray Baker, a beautiful Sunday morning. Birds sang, church bells rang in the distance. Below them was the quaint small village of Kersey. They walked down the slope toward the town, expecting to find a pub or a telephone. Instead, everything just stopped. The bells went silent, the birds vanished, and the only sound left was their footsteps on the grass. But there was something new, the smell of death.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
Where's the first aid kit and extra cash stash?
What's the cash for now?
I gotta pay this guy off to keep quiet.
What are you talking about? What happened?
One of the Beaver Brothers. Yeah, I'm looking at you, Wyatt. One of the Beaver Brothers bit a customer.
What do you mean a customer?
He thought the guy's hand was a biscotti. Look, it was dry, knobbly, and honestly, the guy was asking for it. It's not my fault if he doesn't moisturize.
Why was some guy trying to touch Wyatt?
Oh, that's how we do things here at the Beaver Cafe.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. You bring a date, order a drink, and spend an hour petting a beaver together.
Do you even hear yourself? Do you know how that sounds?
That sounds adorable. It's about connection. It's about touch. It's about beaver enrichment. You know, not a lot of people have experience touching a nice beaver.
You charge people to touch wet beavers.
Oh, there's something healing about it. A warm latte in one hand, a nice wet beaver in the other. Now that's what I call wellness.
Look, what is this really about?
I'm up to death in my beautiful camel latte scented gills. And not only do I have to pay that guy off, I have to pay off my credit card debt. But before that, I need to pay whatever I charged at 2 a.m. when I thought I was buying a hot tub. I gotta stop taking Ambien and going on Amazon.
Okay. Maybe it's time you try PDS Debt.
Did you just slap a QR code on my dignity and call it today's sponsor?
What gave you that idea? You say you want a fresh start, but your debt is still there, and it's getting worse every month. But there is a way out. PDS Debt has helped hundreds of thousands escape debt with personalized plans tailored to your situation. And there's no minimum credit score required. PDS Debt is here to help you save more, pay off debt faster, and start putting money back in your pocket. They're A-plus rated by the BBB and have thousands of five-star reviews on Google and Trustpilot. Proof that PDS Debt is a trusted solution for people who need real help. We've all been there. Debt is overwhelming. The interest piles up and you feel stuck. Waiting only adds more interest and fees. Whether it's credit cards, personal loans, medical bills, or collections, PDS Debt understands your situation and can offer alternative solutions. Don't wait another month. Change your story in 30 seconds. Get your free personalized assessment and the best option for you at PDSDebt.com/files.
PDSDEBT.com/files.
That's right.
Oh, that's one less flaming disaster.
You mean your debt?
No, the IRS audit. Apparently, beaver fondling isn't a valid business discussion. Go figure. Listen, I gotta go. Gertie's back. I sent her for milk, but they ran out, so, she made her own. Honey, you know that's not pasteurized.
William Lang was from Scotland, a stranger to this part of East England. Michael Crowley and Ray Baker were local, all of them sharp, observant, fearless. But nothing in their training prepared them for Kersey. The silence hit them first. One moment, wind blew through the trees and birds sang in the distance. The next moment, nothing. The air went dead. Not quiet, dead. William later described it as an overwhelming feeling of sadness and depression. Something pressed down on them. A weight they could physically feel. The hills behind them showed orange leaves, red maples, and the browns of autumn. That made sense. It was October. But here in the village, everything looked summer green. They walked from October into summer in 10 steps. The village looked empty. No cars on the streets, no people walking between houses, no dogs barking, no children playing, no sounds of Sunday life. But smoke rose from the chimneys, straight gray columns that climbed into the sky without moving. No wind blew them, like they were frozen in time. The cadets felt an irrational animal terror that made them want to run back up the hill, but they pushed forward. The houses looked wrong, timber-framed structures that appeared medieval, but not ruined, not restored, but actively lived in. Yet they lacked every modern feature. No power lines, no television antennas, no telephone poles. Some windows had glass, but most were just open shutters. Their footsteps echoed on the cobblestones. Every sound they made felt too loud, like they broke some unspoken rule just by being there. They did not feel welcome. The church was supposed to be full of people. The streets were supposed to be busy with families walking home from services. Instead, Kersey was a ghost town. They passed a house with its door open. Lang looked inside. Dust floated in the light, but didn't settle. It just hung there. The interior looked lived in, but nobody was there. Near the stream at the village center, ducks stood motionless in the water, not swimming, not moving, just sitting there, silent. The cadets looked up at the trees. The branches didn't move. And something even more unsettling, the trees cast no shadows. They reached a shop window. No glass, just an open hole in the wall. They approached the window, hoping to find someone who could explain what happened. It was a butcher shop. No counters, no cash register, no refrigeration. Just thick wooden planks, dark with old bloodstains and iron hooks hanging from the ceiling. And hanging from the hooks were three oxen carcasses, with flesh rotting off the bone. They weren't the carcasses of cows. They were oxen. Oxen were used as work animals, not for meat. Nobody in England slaughtered oxen anymore. The carcasses hung by their back legs, skinned and gutted. The meat turned completely green with decay, and sticky green fluid dropped from their bodies onto the dusty floor. Then the smell hit them. Old blood and rot. The sweet and metallic stench of meat that sat dead for days in warm weather, decomposing in the open air. On a thick wooden table was a curved butcher's blade, the kind used before industrial slaughterhouses, before stainless steel. It was October in Suffolk, mild weather, perfect condition for flies. And in the real world, rotting meat in October warmth attracts swarms of flies. The cadets should have heard them buzzing from 20 feet away. But there were no flies, no maggots, no insects crawling over green flesh. Nothing moved, because nothing lived here. They looked up, searching for the church tower where the bells rang when they approached. But the tower was gone. The church ended where the nave stopped, half finished. Construction halted in the middle of the build. Then the backs of their necks prickled. They spun around. The windows of the houses were dark, but someone was there. Multiple someones. Hiding in the shadows behind dark windows, someone was watching the three strangers who wandered into their village. And whoever they were, they wanted them to leave. The oppression grew heavier. It pressed down on their shoulders, making it hard to breathe. Michael Crowley started to shiver. His hands shook. His breathing was fast and shallow. Pure terror. The kind that bypasses thought and screams at your brain to run. "We need to leave," he said. His voice sounded flat and dead, like sound couldn't travel through the air. But the cadets agreed, and they didn't walk out of Kersey. They ran. They scrambled up the far hillside, boots slipping on the wet grass, lungs burning. Lang later described running for a few hundred yards before they could even stop. When they finally collapsed on the ridge, gasping for air, they looked back at Kersey. It looked normal. A car drove down the main street. Smoke dispersed naturally in the wind. The church bell rang out, clear and normal. The church tower wasn't mid-construction. It stood tall against the sky. The village was alive again. or alive for the first time since they'd entered it. The green oxen were gone. The quiet was gone. It was like it never happened. But Lang knew what he saw, and he knew Kersey saw him back. The three men didn't speak about their experience for years. They knew how it sounded, and they had careers to protect. In the late 1980s, William Lang went back. Not physically, not yet. He was older now, living in Australia, and the questions never stopped. He talked by phone with Michael Crowley. They went over what happened. Crowley didn't remember in as much detail, but he remembered the quiet, the lack of wires, no streetlights, and he remembered the bizarre butcher shop. Something strange happened that day. They both knew it. Lang wrote to Andrew McKenzie. McKenzie was a psychical researcher who spent decades looking at cases like this. Time slips. Someone seeing the past with their own eyes. McKenzie read Lang's letter. This wasn't just another ghost story. This was something extraordinary. They corresponded for years. McKenzie cross-referenced every detail against historical records. Lang described everything he could remember. The smell, the quiet, the watchers in the windows, the green oxen hanging in a shop that shouldn't have existed. In 1990, McKenzie flew Lang to England, and they walked through Kersey together. The village looked normal. Tourists wandered between the old buildings, cars were parked along the road. The quiet was gone, replaced by ordinary sounds of a living community. Lang found the building that was once the butcher shop. It wasn't a shop anymore, it was a private residence. He knocked on the door. An elderly woman answered. Lang asked about the history of the house, whether it was ever a butcher shop, whether she knew anything about its past. The woman told him it was a private house for as long as anyone could remember. But McKenzie's research showed differently. The building was built in 1350. Records showed it operated as a butcher shop for over a century. Lang's face went pale. 1350 was the year Black Death reached Kersey. The plague killed half of England. People died faster than they could be buried. Farms were abandoned. Animals were slaughtered and left to rot because there was no one left to butcher them. Entire villages were wiped out. But McKenzie's research revealed something more specific. The cadets didn't see Kersey during the plague itself. They saw it afterward, decades afterward. The church tower construction halted in 1348. The shell of the half-built tower stood unfinished for decades. But the village buildings had glazed windows. The wool trade had returned. They were in recovery. McKenzie concluded the cadets saw Kersey as it was around 1420, 70 years after the plague, a village that survived. But the quiet wasn't gone. The trauma of 1350 burned so deeply into Kersey that it could still be experienced 6 centuries later. The land remembered the plague, the absence of life in a place where hundreds died in agony over a period of months. They didn't travel to a parallel universe, they traveled to a memory. The watchers in the windows weren't plague victims, they were the descendants, the survivors, living in houses where their grandparents died. Walking streets where bodies were stacked into piles because there wasn't enough living to bury the dead. The trauma passed down, the fear encoded in the village itself. 600 years apart, they made eye contact through time. The green oxen were the echo. Animals slaughtered in the early days of the outbreak, hung in the butcher shop and then abandoned as the butcher himself sickened and died. The meat rotted because there was no one to cook it, no one to eat it, no one left alive. That image, the waste, the death, the futility, burned into the building so deeply that three boys from Scotland and England walked through the door and saw it again. The three men stayed in touch but never spoke about what they saw. They didn't need to, because on quiet Sunday mornings, when church bells ring in the distance, they still check the street outside their windows, making sure no one is standing there looking back. Gather round. This happened, and it's still unsolved. Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, February 1983. Don Decker stood in the bathroom of his friend's house, washing his hands in the sink. The temperature dropped 30 degrees in a second. He could see his breath. Then he felt a drop of water hit the top of his head. He looked up at the ceiling. Dry. He looked down at the floor. Nothing. The water didn't fall from above. It materialized midair and flew sideways. The water seemed alive, and it was hunting him. Don Decker served time at Monroe County Correctional Facility for receiving stolen property. Don was 21 years old. The stolen property charge was minor, tools taken from a construction site. He got 18 months. In February 1983, he got a temporary furlough to attend his grandfather's funeral. Don felt relieved, but he also felt rage. Not at his grandfather, at himself. For years, he'd pushed down what that old man did to him. The abuse, the way nobody believed him when he tried to tell them. At the funeral, Don stood in the back and watched relatives cry for a man who terrorized him since childhood. His hands started shaking. His chest felt tight. He couldn't breathe. He left before the service ended. During his furlough, Don stayed with friends Bob and Jeannie Kiefer. That night, Don went to the bathroom to splash water on his face. The temperature dropped 30 degrees. He could see his breath. Then he felt a drop of water hit the top of his head. The ceiling was dry. So was the floor. So were the walls. The water was just appearing. The Kiefers called the police. A patrolman arrived at the house expecting a plumbing emergency. What he found wasn't a leaky pipe. He watched water materialize inches from the ceiling and fall on Don Decker wherever he stood. They checked the pipes, the roof, the walls. Everything was dry. The water existed only in the space around Don. When Don's furlough ended, he returned to the prison. He thought he'd be safe inside the concrete walls. He thought whatever happened to him at the Kiefer's house would stay behind. It was wrong. Don sat in his cell, solid concrete, no pipes in the ceiling, no windows to the outside. The sounds of the other prisoners suddenly faded away. The air turned cold. A mist formed near the ceiling. Don looked up. A drop of water hit his face, and then another. Then it began to pour inside his concrete cell. Don screamed for the guards. Officer Walbert ran over, expecting a broken toilet or some kind of prank. He looked through the bars and saw the water. It wasn't collecting on the ceiling. The water materialized a few inches below the ceiling, then fell in a steady stream onto Don Decker. Walbert unlocked the door and stepped inside. He got wet immediately. He checked the ceiling with his hands, bone dry. He checked the walls, also dry. The water existed only in the air around Don. Now, Walbert was a straight arrow. He dealt in facts, evidence, things that could be measured and explained. This was impossible. But his uniform was soaked. And the smell. It didn't smell like tap water or condensation. It smelled like ozone, like the air after a lightning strike, like a thunderstorm was trapped in a concrete box. Don sat on his bunk and muttered to himself. Walbert slowly backed toward the door. He needed to tell the lieutenant. Walbert was a corrections officer for 12 years. He'd seen riots, stabbings, men lose their minds, but he'd never seen the laws of physics break, not until tonight. Walbert looked at Don for an explanation. But Don said nothing. He rocked back and forth with his eyes wide. Then he looked up and smiled. But it wasn't his smile. It was someone else's. Word spread through the prison. Lieutenant Keenhole didn't believe in ghosts or demons or psychic phenomena. He believed in order, discipline, and rational explanations. He heard the reports from his officers and assumed they played some kind of elaborate joke. He marched to the cell block and ordered Walbert to bring Decker to his office. Don was escorted in and sat in a chair across from the lieutenant's desk. A captain sat nearby as a witness. Keenhold didn't waste time. He ordered Don to make it rain in here right now. Don looked at him with a blank expression. He didn't argue or protest. He concentrated. Then the room went silent. The fluorescent lights flickered, and a single drop of water hit the lieutenant's desk. Then the captain looked down. A patch of water appeared on his shirt. It spread across the fabric, soaked through in seconds. His jacket stayed dry. His skin stayed dry. The lieutenant stood up and backed away from his own desk. Then the violence started. An invisible force struck Don from the side. It lifted him out of the chair and threw him against the wall. The captain described what he saw.
He flew across the room with the force as though a bus had hit him. I'd never seen anything like this.
Officers rushed to restrain him. Big men trained to handle prison riots, and they couldn't hold him. Don suddenly had strength far beyond his size. He snarled and thrashed and spoke in a voice that didn't sound like his own. Three deep scratches appeared on his neck, claw marks, as if something invisible raked him with sharp fingers. The officers watched the skin split open in real time. Blood welled up and ran down his collar. There was no weapon, no source. The skin just split open. The guards were right there, close enough to touch him. They saw this happen. Don collapsed to the floor and convulsed. The water continued to fall. It rained in the lieutenant's office. It rained in the hallway. It rained wherever Don went. Then new scratches covered Don's cheeks. Three parallel lines on each side, while six officers watched. Sullen slipped a gold cross into Don's hand. He screamed and threw it to the floor. The metal burned his palm. The officers saw the mark. The lieutenant was running out of ideas. He called the prison chaplain. The chaplain walked into the chaos, saw the water, saw the fear in the eyes of the experienced officers. He opened his Bible and began to read. The water reacted. It turned from rain into a swirling mist that surrounded Don. And then the smell changed. No longer ozone, but sulfur. Then the chaplain felt pressure on his throat, like an invisible hand squeezing. He choked. He couldn't finish the prayer. Whatever held Don Decker was stronger than God. The witnesses were police officers, correctional officers, prison officials, and a chaplain. These were men trained to observe, trained to detect lies, trained to maintain order in chaotic situations. They filed official reports. They went on record. They submitted to interviews. The patrolman who responded to the Kiefer home filed an official report. Officer Wolbert maintains to this day that everything he saw was real.
I've been a cop for 12 years. I've never seen anything like this. The water fell, but there was no source.
Lieutenant Keenhold confirmed the water phenomena. Multiple guards corroborated the scratches appearing on Don's skin. The Kiefer family described identical events in their home. These witnesses had no reason to lie. Still, they were ridiculed. But they couldn't deny what they saw with their own eyes, felt with their own hands, and smelled with their own noses. Don Decker was released a few days after the incidents peaked. He left Stroudsburg, and the rain stopped. The prison dried out. Don eventually settled into a normal life, married, had children. The phenomenon never went away, but never returned with the same intensity. Years later, a documentary crew came to Stroudsburg to film the story for Unsolved Mysteries. This was 9 years after the prison incident. On the last day of filming, the crew woke up in their hotel. 2 inches of water covered the floors of their rooms. The hallway was flooded. No broken pipes, no leaks, just water that appeared overnight. Parapsychologists have a name for this: recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis, RSPK. It's been documented over 100 times. Some people who go through extreme trauma experience physical effects. Don had a lifetime of rage locked inside him, years of abuse with no outlet. When his grandfather died, that rage had to go somewhere. So it turned into rain. It turned into invisible claws. It turned into a force powerful enough to terrify an entire prison. Don's story proves that the human mind, under enough pressure, can break reality itself. We walk around every day with that potential locked inside of us. All of us. Most of the time, the safeties hold. The triggers don't get pulled. But sometimes, for some people, the pressure becomes too much, and the world we think we understand starts to fall apart. Don Decker settled into a normal life. He got married and had kids, though he never told his kids what happened. But sometimes when his children cry, like really cry, the kind that comes from deep hurt, a single drop of water appears on their bedroom ceiling. But Don wipes it away before anyone can see. Gather round. This happened, and it's still unsolved. April 5th, 2015. A YouTube channel appeared with a nonsense name, Unfavorable Semicircle. That first day, that channel uploaded 1,247 videos within 24 hours. The first was titled The Sagittarius Symbol, followed by 980708. It was 4 seconds long, a brown background, no sound. Then another video appeared. And another, and another. The channel uploaded a video every few minutes, then every few seconds, Within 9 months, it posted over 72,000 videos. No human could do that. The internet noticed. They thought it was a bot or a glitch. Then they started combining the videos. Thousands of frames assembled into composites. An image appeared. A man in what looked like a suit, but he had no face. His face wasn't blurred. It wasn't there, like someone had erased it from reality. To understand how strange unfavorable semicircle was, you need to understand the scale. YouTube's upload system has limits: verification, processing, compression. Each video takes time. Now, a dedicated creator might upload one video per day. A prolific channel might manage 10 or more per week. Unfavorable semicircle started at one video every 10 minutes, around the clock. Then it accelerated. By February 5th, 2016, the rate hit 3 videos per minute. No breaks, no pauses, for months. YouTube's infrastructure in 2015 wasn't built for this. They limited creators to 10 to 15 uploads a day unless you had a special agreement. Even verified channels with dedicated upload pipelines couldn't sustain more than 50 videos a day. So 3 per minute? That required direct server access, backend permissions that shouldn't exist. And the content made no sense. Each video was different, but they followed patterns. Abstract shapes, flickering colors, bursts of static. Some were 4 seconds long, some lasted hours. The longest ran 11 hours. Some were completely silent. Others contained high-pitched screeching that made your ears hurt. The visuals looked like test patterns from a television station. Pixels arranged in grids. Geometric shapes that pulsed and shifted. Colors that flashed so rapidly they triggered headaches. Some viewers reported nausea, disorientation. One Reddit user said he watched for 3 hours and lost track of time. When he checked the clock, 6 hours had passed. Another reported ringing in his ears that lasted for days. And the titles were equally strange. Numbers mostly, 18600-9847. But sometimes symbols appeared. The Sagittarius symbol followed by the word D-Lock. Sagittarius, brother. Sagittarius, brill. The Sagittarius symbol showed up constantly. And it wasn't typed, it was hand-drawn. Each one slightly different, like someone sketched it frame by frame, thousands of times. That kind of repetition meant this was intentional. The channel flew under the radar for months. Then in November 2015, someone in Reddit posted, "Found something weird." The thread had 3 responses. By December, it had 200. People built databases, wrote scripts to download and analyze every video. They used spectrograms to visualize audio, custom Python scripts to extract frames. One user built a database tracking every upload timestamp, looking for patterns in the intervals. By December, the investigation had its own subreddit with detailed documentation of every discovery. Reddit user Jackalackadingdong, that was his handle, he spent months on the audio files.
"I felt really uneasy listening to this, trying to pick out the sequence. The whole thing is quite unsettling."
They treated it like a puzzle. A message hidden in the noise. One composite showed the man with no face. Another showed space imagery, satellites, celestial objects. And buried in the audio was a voice reading coordinates, latitude and longitude, pointing to a spot somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. During the Cold War, intelligence agencies used shortwave radio to communicate with sleeper agents. These were called number stations, anonymous broadcasts that transmitted strings of digits day after day, year after year. The numbers meant nothing to anyone who didn't have the cipher. To everyone else, they were just noise. Some researchers believed unfavorable semicircle was the digital equivalent, modern number station hiding in plain sight on the world's largest video platform. Alan Woodward, a computer security specialist at University of Surrey, said it was too complex to be a number station. Recruitment puzzles like Cicada 3301 were announced. This wasn't. Whatever unfavorable semicircle was, it wasn't advertising. The channel had almost no subscribers. It wasn't trying to go viral. It was broadcasting into the void. And whoever was supposed to receive the message already knew where to look. But then something unexpected happened. The channel started reacting to the investigators. The Reddit community would post a theory about a specific type of video, and the channel would stop uploading that type. They would decode a title pattern, and the channel would switch naming conventions. They would identify a recurring symbol, and the symbol would disappear from future uploads. On January 12, 2016, a Reddit thread identified a pattern in the Sagittarius symbols. Within 4 hours, the channel uploaded 47 new videos. Not one contained that symbol. Something was watching them, listening, and adapting in real time, monitoring, and responding. This proved there was an intelligence behind an unfavorable semicircle, human or otherwise. On February 25th, 2016, the BBC published an article calling it YouTube's strangest mystery. Hours later, at 1540 Eastern, YouTube suspended the channel. They cited terms of service violations, specifically spam. The upload volume was crashing their systems. 4 days before the ban, Reddit user It's Safer Indoors registered unfavorablesemicircle.com. He built a database, archived thousands of videos. He saved 23,000 videos before the ban, almost a third of the total output. Hours of footage, gigabytes of data. The mystery seemed over. But 3 weeks later, it came back. A new channel appeared, same name, same aesthetic, same flood of uploads. It picked up exactly where the original left off, as if the suspension never happened. But this time the content was different, more aggressive. Videos stretched to 10 hours long, 10 hours of silence and a black screen, with a single pixel changing color once per hour. It was testing patience, testing commitment, seeing who would watch. Then came the lock videos, a series that, when played together in sequence, created something strange. When the frames were combined side by side, an image appeared. A Reddit user made the discovery. In 2022, the creator confirmed what it showed. The Voyager Golden Record, the message humanity sent to aliens in 1977. Unfavorable semicircle was responding to our message to the stars. The final broadcast came without warning, encoded in a garbled post on the channel's Google Plus page. When decoded, it revealed coordinates, latitude and longitude. The investigators typed them into Google Maps. They expected to find a building, or a military base, a server farm, something that would explain everything. The pin dropped in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, miles from any landmass. 3,000 feet of water, dark and cold. And according to old sonar data, an object is down there. Now, we don't know what it is. We only know it's 130 feet long and made of metal. Unfavorable Semicircle was eventually banned for good. The creator never came forward. No art student claimed it as a project. No ARG company took credit. No intelligence agency admitted involvement. It remains one of the internet's purest mysteries. The theories multiplied. Some believed it was a stress test, someone probing YouTube's compression algorithms looking for vulnerabilities. Others thought it was a botnet demonstration. A few thought it was a recruitment puzzle, a way for a shadowy organization to identify codebreakers and analysts. But before the channel disappeared completely, one final video appeared. September 15, 2017. Reset Strange YD. Then the channel deleted itself. Every video vanished. That same day, NASA retired the Cassini space probe after 20 years, the probe that photographed Saturn, that explored the outer planets. Unfavorable Semicircle ended the day Cassini burned up in Saturn's atmosphere. In 2022, someone claiming to be the creator broke silence on Twitter. He said it was an outsider art project. The goal was to upload the most number of YouTubes ever to see if people would watch. But that doesn't explain everything. It doesn't explain the composite image of the faceless man. It doesn't explain the coordinates to an empty spot in the ocean. And it doesn't explain why the channel reacted to investigators in real time, changing its behavior when people got too close. Engineers who worked on the case said the videos bypassed normal processing. They went straight to YouTube servers. No verification, no compression checks. It was like someone had hard-coded a pathway that the platform's own systems didn't recognize. When they finally traced the upload source, it led to a data center in Iceland. The equipment was offline and had been for months. Now, after the channel disappeared, copycat accounts appeared. dozens of them, reposting the original videos. Some claim to be archivists, some claim to be the original creator. One account posted new videos in the same style, at the same impossible upload rate. It lasted 6 days before YouTube shut it down. Then another appeared, then another, like the signal was trying to stay alive. YouTube's infrastructure can handle millions of uploads per day, but one account uploading 3 videos per minute for months? That broke something. But when YouTube finally banned the account, they didn't just delete the videos, they closed the upload pathway, sealed it. But in 2022, that door opened again. Different channel, same upload rate. Gone 48 hours before anyone noticed. Now what about the coordinates? A spot in the Atlantic, under 3,000 feet of water. And according to that old sonar data, something's down there, 130 feet long and metallic. The sonar reading dated back to 1982, a research vessel conducting deep ocean mapping. They logged the object, ran multiple passes to confirm. The signature didn't match any known geological formation. The crew reported it to the Navy. The Navy classified it. Every few months, someone reports hearing the signal again. But it's not coming from YouTube. It's coming from the bottom of the ocean. Thank you so much for hanging out today. My name is AJ. This is The Y-Files, and that was a campfire story. No debunking, no analysis, just a creepy story to scare you and the kids. And that one is true and unsolved. Now, if you had fun, I'd appreciate it if you can like, subscribe, comment, and share. That stuff really helps. And like most topics we cover here, today's was recommended by you. So if there's a story you'd like to see, go to thewyfiles.com/tips or send us an email. We'd love to cover that story. And if you'd like to hear any of these campfire stories expanded into a full episode, there's a few I'd like to do, then definitely let me know. Remember, The Y-Files is also a podcast. You can take us on the road. I post deep dives into the stories we cover on the channel. I also post episodes that wouldn't be allowed on the channel. The podcast is called The Y-Files, Operation Podcast, and it's available everywhere. And if you're listening on an audio platform, do me a favor, hit the thumbs up or the like or the follow or whatever those buttons are. Those really do help. Now, if you need more Y-Files in your life, check out our Discord. We're about to hit 100,000 members over there. It's a lot of fun. It's a really supportive community. There's someone on there 24/7, and it's free to join. Speaking of 24/7, check out our 24/7. I'm plowing through the plugs. Speaking of 24/7, make sure you check out our 24/7 stream in the Y-Files backstage. Over there, we run episodes back to back with some fun content in between, and the live chat is super, super fun. Special thanks to our patrons who make this channel possible and make every episode of The Y-Files happen. Every episode is dedicated to our Patreon members. I could not do this without you. And if you'd like to support the channel, keep us going, consider becoming a member on Patreon. For as little as $3 a month, get access to perks like videos early with no commercials, exclusive merch, and 2 private live streams every week just for you to hear the whistle on my teeth. It's because I'm going too fast. The private live streams are a lot of fun for members only. My webcam is on. Everyone on the team has their camera on. You can talk to all of us. Turn your camera on, jump up on stage, ask a question. I think it's the best perk there is. Another great way to support the channel, grab something from the Y-Files store. That is shop@thewyfiles.com. You'll find it. But if you're going to buy merch, become a member on YouTube. YouTube members get 10% off everything in the Y-Files store forever. So if you're going to spend $40 on t-shirts and festival mugs, become a member on YouTube for $3. It pays for itself. And that money goes to the team, not to me. Those are the plugs. I got through them as fast as I could. And that's going to do it. Till next time, be safe, be kind, and know that you are appreciated.
In Area 51, a secret code inside the Bible said I was. I love my UFOs and paranormal fun, as well as music, so I'm singing like I should. But then another conspiracy theory becomes the truth, my friends, and it never ends. No, it never ends. And got stuck inside Mel's home with MK Ultra. I've been only too aware. Did Stanley Kubrick fake the moon landing alone on a film set? Or were the shadow people there?
Roswell aliens just fought the smiling man, I'm told, and his name was Cold.
And I can't believe I'm dancing with the fishes. Heck of fish on Thursday nights with AJ2 and the solar storm still come to Agatha, the secret city underground. Mysterious number stations, planet Serpo 2, Project Stargate, and what the Dark Watchers found.
In a simulation, don't you worry though,
the Black Knight satellite, it told me so. I can't believe Thursday nights with AJ2 and the Wildfires on the beat all through the night. All I ever wanted was to just hear the truth, so the Wildfires on the beat all through the night. Head for fish on Thursday nights with AJ2 and the Wildfires on the beat all through the night. All I ever wanted was to just hear
camel.